Welcome to CorpWatch Radio, your biweekly review of corporate news. Coming up, our headlines will take us from the corporate influence over the Mexican elections to the shady tactics of pharmaceutical giants for keeping their profits high. Next, we will interview Prothap Chatterjee about the recent cancellation of Halliburton's exclusive contract for military services in Iraq. But first, for the week of July 12th to July 17th, I'm Sakura Saunders.
And I'm Stephen Valentino.
And these are your CorpWatch headlines.
U.S. lawmakers voted down an amendment last week to a telecommunications bill that would have guaranteed equal access to broadband services for content providers. The amendment would have barred internet service providers like AT&T and Verizon from charging higher prices to content providers like Google or any other website for a faster internet connection. Advocates of net neutrality fear this means that wealthy corporations will be able to ensure that their websites load quickly, while small businesses, nonprofits, and individuals will have to settle for slow-loading, difficult-to-access pages. A coalition of internet content companies, civil libertarians, consumer groups, and other activists have pledged to reintroduce the legislation. They face opposition mainly from the telecom giants, who contend that they should be free to charge what they please for the use of their infrastructure, even if that infrastructure consists of telephone lines and fiber optic cable that form the basis of the internet itself. They further contend that the profit they would enjoy would be reinvested in developing new and faster technologies that would ultimately make the internet better for everyone. The argument rings hollow for critics who say that the very future of the internet as a democratic force may be sacrificed at the altar of profit.
As Felipe Calderón appeared to emerge with a razor-thin winning margin in Mexico's still-contested presidential race, questions began as to how this business-friendly dark horse suddenly emerged victorious. He did it, it appears, with the help from a last-minute fear campaign funded by Mexico's major industry interests. In the days leading up to the July 2nd vote, the Mexican Business Coordinating Council funded a series of television spots urging voters to support Calderón, a fiscal conservative like outgoing President Vicente Fox. The advertisements implied that a victory by Calderón's leftist opponent, López Obrador, would mean economic collapse. Obrador accused the business group, whose members include major banks like BBVA Bancomer and Banamex, and cement giant Cermex, of whipping up a fear campaign, calling its members, quote, influence peddlers and white-collar crooks.
The former CEO of HealthSouth, Richard Scrushy, has been convicted in a bribery case involving former Alabama Governor Don Siegelman, who was also convicted. Scrushy agreed to donate $500,000 to Siegelman's reelection campaign in exchange for a position on the state's hospital advisory board. Siegelman lost the Democratic nomination for governor in the June primary. Scrushy was previously involved in a 2003 corporate accounting scandal at HealthSouth, in which he was accused of instructing HealthSouth employees to exaggerate company earnings in order to increase the price of the company's stock. He was acquitted of all fraud charges against him by the SEC last year. Now convicted on bribery, conspiracy, and fraud charges, Scrushy could receive a 20-year prison sentence and up to $250,000 in fines. HealthSouth, which is based in Birmingham, Alabama, is the largest healthcare provider in the U.S.
You're listening to CorpWatch Radio. For more information about any of these stories, go to www.corpwatch.org. In a report issued last week, Consumers International, the World Federation of Consumer Organizations, sternly reprimanded drug companies, accusing the pharmaceutical industry of deliberately endangering public health by misleading consumers through deceptive marketing practices. These practices include encouraging physicians to prescribe their drugs and convincing consumers that certain drugs are necessary. Many of the companies cited in the report were said to have had inappropriate dealings with healthcare professionals in the past. The study notes that drug companies spent a whopping $60 billion on marketing campaigns last year, double the amount spent on research. This doesn't sit well with most Americans, many of whom have long been frustrated with high drug prices, which drug companies attribute to high costs in research and development.
Also in pharmaceutical news, members of Congress are reevaluating an FDA measure designed to ensure the safety of market-bound drugs. Certain FDA officials, lawmakers, and generic drug makers in particular are concerned that citizen petitions are being circulated by brand-name drug companies to subvert the generic drug approval process in order to maintain market dominance. Citizen petitions may be filed by any individual or group, including companies, who wish the FDA to further examine certain drugs or policies. These petitions can take up to several years to process. Senators Debbie Stabenow and Trent Lott have introduced legislation that, if passed, would regulate petitions filed by pharmaceutical companies. In support of this legislation, they revealed that 20 out of 21 petitions settled by the FDA have since been tossed out. Soaring drug prices in recent years have also increased the demand for generic drugs, which are up to 75% cheaper than their brand-name counterparts.
Greenpeace International recently praised computer giant Dell for its commitment to phase out the use of toxic brominated flame retardants, or BFRs, and hazardous plastic, PVC, by 2009. Campaigners report a change of attitude in the electronics industry, signified by similar commitments from Sony, LGE, Samsung, Nokia, and HP. Meanwhile, other companies have reneged on similar agreements. Motorola informed Greenpeace that it would not follow through on its commitment to phase out BFRs and PVC. BFRs are suspected endocrine disruptors, or substances that either block, disrupt, or mimic hormones in the body. BFRs also accumulate over time in animal tissue. Recently, high levels of BFRs have been detected in human blood and breast milk. Detroit giant Ford Motor Company irked environmentalists last week by announcing that it would not live up to its commitment to produce 250,000 hybrid vehicles by the year 2010. Instead, the company will concentrate on the production of flexible fuel vehicles, said Chief Executive Bill Ford Jr. Flex fuel vehicles are able to run on mixed fuels, generally part gasoline, part ethanol. There are currently 5 million such vehicles on the road in the U.S., although filling stations that offer alternative ethanol-based fuel are few and far between. While ethanol is touted as a green fuel, recent studies have indicated that the merits of corn-derived ethanol fuel may not outweigh its negatives. While ethanol burns cleaner than gasoline, its production generates tremendous amounts of CO2 and other air pollutants because it is produced in largely coal-powered plants. In addition, large-scale hybrid corn cultivation requires a lot of energy to produce and has been found to have devastating effects on the environment through fertilizer and pesticide runoff and topsoil erosion. At best, ethanol is a zero-sum solution from an environmental perspective. The Sierra Club criticized Ford's announcement, saying that it was appalled by the Ford Motor Company's step backwards. On July 12th, the Pentagon announced that it was discontinuing its multi-million dollar contract with oil services giant Halliburton. This exclusive contract was scrutinized by watchdogs, who complained that the politically connected corporation was profiting off the war, at the expense of the U.S. taxpayer and Iraq itself. We are here with Prothap Chatterjee, author of Iraq Incorporated, and executive director of CorpWatch. CorpWatch has, for the past 3 years, published annual reports on Halliburton, preparing these investigative reports for each consecutive Halliburton shareholder meeting. Prothap, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
So first off, what contract got canceled today?
Okay, Halliburton actually does two major jobs in Iraq, or has for the last 3 years. One is they were part of something called the Restore Iraq Oil Project, which was to fix Iraq's oil fields for the Iraqi people. They're also part of a global contract called LOGCAP, which is the Logistics Civilian Augmentation Program, and that is to provide logistical support to troops around the world, but especially in Iraq. The bulk of that work, probably 80% of that, is in Iraq. And that contract, the second contract for logistical support for the military, got canceled. Incidentally, the first contract was partially canceled several months ago when Halliburton was fired from its work in northern Iraq because it did such a bad job. It still retains the southern Iraq part of that job. But today what's changing is this giant multi-billion dollar contract, which was signed actually originally in 2001, for 1 year, extendable for an additional 9 years, up to 10 years, to work everywhere in the world at a moment's notice for the military to build bases, maintain bases, and do any other job required for supporting troops in the field.
And what was the reason that they got their contract canceled?
Well, the Army has not specified exactly why they have chosen not to renew the contract, but it has been very clear to Army investigators that the company has not been providing proper paperwork, has been overcharging, and generally doing quite a poor job in terms of containing costs and maintaining efficient operations for the military in a time where, money is scarce. So at some point, also perhaps because of criticism from groups like ourselves, such as Corp Watch, particularly from government watchdog agencies like the Defense Criminal Investigative Service, the Defense Contract Audit Agency, the General Accounting Office, Halliburton, has been under scrutiny for overcharging. A number of members of Congress, especially Henry Waxman of Southern California, has also been very critical of this overcharging and using those government military audits to prove that the company is not doing, a sufficient job in containing costs. So at some point, I guess the Army has decided that enough is enough, and it is not willing to pay top dollar for, a bad product. And so they are now choosing to break the contract up into three different parts in the hope that they will be able to get more competition, and they will in fact hire a fourth company to monitor the first three companies, because they feel that like they'll get a better product at the end of the day and better support and cheaper support. Whether that will happen remains to be seen. It's not necessarily better to have three companies doing the job of one in the middle of a war zone. The question really is actually making the company accountable for its overcharging, which the Army has consistently failed to do over the last 3 years.
That brings up an interesting question. As a corporate watchdog, you've criticized the privatization of these services that were once performed by the military itself. What are the negative consequences of this sort of privatization?
Well, there are both negative and positive consequences of doing this. One of the positive consequences of doing this is it allows soldiers to focus on what, they've been trained to do, which is fight a war. And so they use their weapons, they go out and conduct raids and that sort of thing, but they're not necessarily most efficiently used to, clean toilets and wash clothes and what have you. So by bringing in a private contractor, it enables the soldiers, and not many soldiers are present in Iraq, to be able to do the job they're there for or whatever. On the other hand, and of course, if Halliburton does its job well, and if one would hope they would hire people and use good services, that they would actually provide something that the troops would appreciate. And in fact, many troops do appreciate the fact that because Halliburton is working, they have hot showers, they have four square meals a day, they have lobsters and ice cream and all sorts of other amenities that would not normally be provided by 18-year-olds who have, gone through basic training and don't want to be there in the first place. So there's this huge benefit. But at the same time, Halliburton charges top dollar for this, so it doesn't come cheap. They charge $28 a meal, regardless of whether it's eaten or not. This is very expensive. And when you think about it, you could eat at the best hotel and have the finest meal in Iraq all day, and that would cost you $28. And yet, for each soldier, we're talking, $112 that's being spent on meals, whether or not they eat them per day. And what's regrettable is that Halliburton charges this top dollar, but then they pay their workers very, very badly. Almost all of their workers are either from India or the Philippines or Pakistan or Sri Lanka or Nepal or South and also South and Southeast Asia, but also the Middle East. And they paid them $300 a month. Sometimes they use subcontractors who don't even pay their workers. And so the tragedy is, even though the soldiers are getting often good conditions to live under, the workers are often treated extremely badly. Their passports are seized. They are often brought to work in a war zone against their knowledge and their will. So the company is profiting, the soldiers are doing well, but the workers of Halliburton, in fact, are treated very, very badly. And so this is something, in fact, the army is not actually dealing with. The army is saying, we'll turn the contract over to somebody else, but they're not saying, we need you to treat your workers better. They have said, made some declarations to that effect to some of the subcontractors, but this is really about trying to save a certain amount of money and to appear like they are cracking down on a company that's overcharging. In actual fact, the army has paid them all their overcharges and has not really even canceled any work for overcharging.
So do you think Halliburton is upset about the fact that this contract has been canceled for them?
I actually think that Halliburton's probably happy that the contract is canceled, because Halliburton over the last couple of years has become increasingly aware that this is creating an extremely bad name for them, because they have become synonymous with overcharging, with profiting out of the war, and they are continuously linked back to their former CEO, Dick Cheney, who's the vice president of the United States, and people always assume that it is a corrupt deal. Whether or not it is really hard to determine, but it is a sort of a millstone around Halliburton's neck. The other problem that Halliburton has is this work actually doesn't pay very well in terms of the profit margin they report to their shareholders. So they get a 1% profit with a 2% bonus. So at most they can get 3% on it. By contrast, their oil and gas business makes 25% profit. And the 25% profit, you know, that business in fact is booming. Oil and gas business, unfortunately, because gas prices are going up, is on the up and up. So Halliburton, whereas its work in Iraq shrank last year, its oil business boomed and more than made up for that. So Halliburton would rather invest its dollars in doing oil and gas work, of which it sees a plentiful and growing future, than work in a place where their workers get killed, they get criticized, and then they have to go into legal battles over whether or not they deserve this extra 3%.
And, of course, the 3% has something to do with why they're overcharging in order to get the extra profit.
Halliburton gets a very small rate of return on its work in Iraq, which is 3%. And that is really not a very good rate of return, given the kind of work that Halliburton does, such as oil and gas drilling and that sort of thing. So they would like to get out of it. However, because it you know, reflects badly on their balance sheet, shareholders, Wall Street say, oh, you know, this is just dragging down your business. You are making 3% and you have a whole problem. Now, the reality is, of course, the company makes a lot more than that 3%, but it's not maybe as something that's as well known to shareholders. And the way they do that is by providing unnecessary services. So where they would get $3 in every $100 in services provided, if they build extra buildings or buy extra services that are unnecessary, they can charge $3 for every extra $100 they charge, even whether it's not used. So they may buy 4 trucks in place of 1, and so they'll get 12% instead of 3%, but the rest of the money is wasted to the taxpayer because it's never used. It's not something that shows up necessarily against their Wall Street rating, because Wall Street still sees it as a 3% profit.
And they overcharge for services as well. In addition to having bogus services in general, you mention a lot of money spent on soda cans and things like that. Could you go over some of the examples of this overcharging?
Sure. Halliburton has very little internal cost control, and partly it's because of a very lax attitude towards keeping costs, you know, under control. And it's because they know that the more they spend, the more 3% on the expenses they get. And so when somebody hands them a bill that's high, they, rather than trying to go and reduce that bill, they certainly at the level of line supervisors have often encouraged overcharging. So to give you an example, they paid $100 a bag for laundry in Kuwait, when that same bag of laundry could be done at the same by the same company for a fifth of that price, and was being done at a fifth of that price, you know, on a at a different location. So the company accepted, you know, bills that were very high, $45 for a case of soda, and in fact that was probably due to a mistaken billing. But they never bothered to go and correct the error because they realized that they could benefit. They could get 3% more on whatever their extra charge was. And of course, the company that may have made a mistake deliberately or otherwise would also gain from it. And it is clear that some of those companies, some of the subcontractors, like a company like La Nouvelle, for example, were clearly charging the highest possible prices they could do so. And sometimes it was even with a nod and wink from Halliburton's own supervisors, who then got a kickback later. There's several examples. There's a guy by the name of Jeff Alex Mazon. And Jeff Alex Mazon was asked to get a contract for Halliburton to ship oil. And so he asked La Nouvelle to help him on this. And when they submitted their bid, he personally, as an employee of Halliburton, tripled the bid before submitting it to the military. So as a result, what was a bid for $1.5 million was then submitted for $5.5 million. And when he quit the company, La Nouvelle wrote him a check for $1 million. So on all of these contracts, Halliburton was collecting, you know, a percentage. And so whether the upper management knew it or not, certainly it was done with the connivance of Halliburton's contract managers. Another example is a guy by the name of Christopher Joseph Cahill, who was overcharging for shipments from Dubai to Iraq, where he was claiming that the company needed a charge for an insurance that they had never bought. Now, it may have been a mistake, but he was completely aware that this was not necessary. In fact, he pleaded guilty later to having overcharged for that. I mean, both of these are based on these two gentlemen, Jeff Alex Mazin and Christopher Cahill, saying yes, they overcharged knowingly, and they are now both in jail. However, Halliburton has said, you know, well, these were, you know, a couple of bad apples. Upper management was not aware. I know, because I know people at senior levels in Halliburton, that the company at the very highest ranks of its management was aware of this, and in fact was worried about this because they realized it was completely out of control. And memos were sent in December 2003 from somebody who was very previously worked for the military, very high up in the administration, who now works for Halliburton, who said, we are going to get into a lot of trouble if this is discovered.
But they didn't get into a lot of trouble. Halliburton was still paid for all of those disputed costs. Is that correct?
Halliburton was paid for all the disputed costs, and partly it's because they... Now, here's the thing. The disputed costs, in fact, may not necessarily mean they were criminal overcharges at all. Some of the times, Halliburton lost the paperwork, and it may well have been a reasonable expense. But Henry Waxman, you know, a representative for the Santa Monica area in Southern California, has demonstrated that $1.4 billion, you know, good over 10% of what the company had spent by July of last year in Iraq, you know, were not supported. And so what the army was trying to decide was their paperwork, was this valid, or was it an overcharge? But because Halliburton said, well, if you don't pay this, you know, we're going to charge more, you know, for other projects, the army decided to pay them all the disputed costs. They refused to pay Halliburton a $9 million charge. But after taking away the $9 million payment, they then gave them $250 million in unsupported charges and bonuses and what have you. So the company got, you know, a light little sort of tap on the shoulder, but was then given a giant bonus and charges were dropped, even though the company had never adequately been able to prove they were not how they had come up with all these charges.
And so now Halliburton, even though they got their contract canceled, they're still eligible to apply for the contract that's now being divided up into three categories when the Army reoffers it. What are you going to be looking for in the future with these contracts? And who do you think is going to apply for them?
Well, there are actually very many contractors out there who bid on contracts of this size. There are many other engineering companies such as Bechtel and Parsons and Fluor and Amec. So it's very likely that these companies will apply for them. Contracts have often been cancelled, but because the bonuses have always been paid, because the companies have never been barred from any of this work, it means that they have really gotten away scot-free. They have lost lucrative future work, but they have not been penalized for any problems in the past. So, and Halliburton is eligible to go back. So they can only get one part out of three parts of the contract. It may be the biggest part, but they can always go back and apply for that. And in fact, this has happened in the past. When Halliburton lost the contract under the Clinton administration to DynCorp, DynCorp then subcontracted Halliburton. And I think you will see that anyway. I think that Halliburton may leave the building, but Halliburton's employees may stay and work for a different employer. I think that is very likely to happen, is that somebody else will take over. One of the new companies that have been created, such as First Kuwaiti or PwC of Kuwait or Prime Projects International of Dubai, will then take over the main contract. But it's removing the percentage of profit that's going to Halliburton, but it's not actually changing the system itself. It's a marginal cost saving. It may be this, you know, the same workers, just a different boss.
And so what are you going to be looking out for in the future with these contracts?
Well, first of all, I mean, we would hope that Halliburton would pay its workers a working wage, and it would not traffic them into war zones. It would allow them to leave when they want to. We would expect that of any contractor that took the job afterwards. They treat their workers from South and Southeast Asia decently. But we also want to obviously scrutinize anything that Halliburton may continue to do, because it may well continue to do part of the work in the future. And of course, a critical element of Iraq's oil needs is not being met and is still a contract that Halliburton has not fulfilled. And it is not covered by this current contract cancellation. And that is the simple task of installing oil meters in Iraq's port in order to ensure that oil is not being stolen and smuggled either by people in the port or people buying it from overseas, so that the income goes back to the people of Iraq. And I think this would add insult to injury if this job is not done properly. As it is years overdue, and it is something that is critical in order to ensure that the people of Iraq get, you know, the oil revenue they need to be able to build their schools and build hospitals and roads and pay for food rations and what have you. And it's a simple task, and Halliburton or somebody needs to do it and do it well.
And what's the consequence of them not doing it well? Do you know how much money this is costing?
I don't know. That's part of a new report. I have no idea. So I'm investigating it to find out exactly what it is. Because this is how money is being stolen. You know, they say, well, the ministry is stealing the money. It's true. Iraqis are stealing the money. But Halliburton is helping them by not installing the oil meters that, you know, was supposed to be installed. So they either, it may just be, it may not be deliberate, connivance or some such thing, but it's a job that has been failed to be done.
Okay, well, thanks so much for taking time out to do an interview today.
No problem. Thank you, Sukhra.
That's all for this week's edition of Corp Watch Radio, brought to you by corpwatch.org. A special thanks to David Morley, Lisa Zhu, and Liam O'Donohue for research assistance, Brooke Biggs for editorial support, and Stephen Valentino for anchoring. Also, thanks to Pacifica, Odeo.com, and Indie Media for distribution assistance. You have heard music from The Art Ensemble of Chicago, Sleater-Kinney, and Outhud. I'm your host, Sakura Saunders. Thanks for listening.